Just here from the United Kingdom, UK, from Dr. Brenton Manor and his wife, Gandharvika. Also, Dr. Sheena is also here from the UK. They are all part of the Child Protection Office people. We've been very, very fortunate that in the last few months, Kamlesh Krishna Prabhu has taken over the position of the Director of the International Child Protection Office. I've been working with him for a few months, as others have, and we've just been delighted with the wonderful things that we've seen from the Child Protection Office, and we're very, very encouraged in the future and how things are going. They've been visiting for a while here. Of course, they just had the birth of their grandchild in the last year, which has also helped to bring them here. But at any rate, we're very happy that they were here with us. And I'm going to turn over to Kamlesh and whatever statement you want to make, or you know, we'll have a lot of time for questions and answers, so please tune in.
Hare Krishna. Welcome. I hope you've all got enough space, because it's a bit crowded in here this evening. You know, so thank you very much for taking the time to come this evening. Now, what we'd like to do is to discuss child protection and take your questions, essentially, and your thoughts about child protection. But one thing that I'd like to say is that we can't discuss personal cases, because, you know, that's not appropriate, really. So that's what we'd like to cover this evening. Let me introduce you to my wife, Gandharvika. Now, as I always say, that I hold the title and she does the work. She's the real force behind child protection. And of course, we have the Child Protection Director for the UK with us also this evening, which is Dakshina. And again, she does the work and helps international. And we also have Neela Sukha with us, who is the North American Child Protection Director. So, you know, we have a bit of a tour de force this evening as far as child protection is concerned, apart from myself. So, over to you. Any questions, any thoughts? What would you like to know about child protection?
Just to get started, maybe you can tell us a little bit about
the mic. Yeah. Oh, okay.
Well, this let me settle you.
I just want to move away from the speaker.
Why don't you tell us a little bit about what your vision is for the International Child Protection Office, what you'd like to see done with it,
and where you see your role and how we can expand child protection throughout the world.
Cool. That's quite a large task. Now, as far as my vision for child protection is concerned, is that we build up a system, a structure, an organization, in that every temple throughout the world has a presence for child protection, and that team actively work with that community, that temple, to create an environment that's safe to bring up our children. So that is the larger vision. How do we achieve that? Achieve that through awareness throughout our organization about the recognition of what is child protection, why is it important, and how do we ensure that we look after our children. So that is the larger picture. How are we proceeding? Well, we're going by country by country, temple by temple, and trying to increase the awareness, asking devotees to come forward and take part in child protection. We're quite happy to provide training, resources, etc. But we cannot cover every temple without the assistance and the help from devotees around the world. Did you want to add a little bit more to it? No? So that in essence is the larger picture that we have. Okay. So this is going to be hopefully a questions and answers session. So does anyone have any questions? My word, deathly silence. this is gonna be a short meeting.
Okay, when a complaint comes to the child protection office, then what's the process? How does it work through the system?
Okay. Lila, from North America.
Okay. So if someone contacts the child protection office, either North American or international, and there's an allegation that a child has been abused or neglected, then we would just essentially start with inquiries. Where did it happen, to establish jurisdiction, if it's CPO jurisdiction or not? Have it been reported to the local law enforcement in the United States? That is a go-to option. In a place like India, it's less of a useful step, although we do need to ask, what has happened? What is the current set of circumstances? If we establish that the issue is within CPO jurisdiction, which means that it either happened on ISKCON property, or the alleged offender is somebody who serves in a trusted position currently or at the time of the allegation. So either it happened on ISKCON property or the person serves in a trusted position, that is then CPO jurisdiction, and a case is pursued. An investigation is done by collecting testimony from the individuals involved with the help of local devotees. And after enough testimony and evidence has been collected, the CPO process is selecting review panelists. Those are devotees who have been specially trained to look at testimony and evidence and decide two things. Is it likely that the abuse occurred or not? If it's not, the case stops. If it is, then it goes on to review and case conclusion. When those three individuals look at all of the witness testimony, evidence, anything that's been collected, and come up with a decision of what will the requirements be to place upon the accused in order for them to have a relationship with ISKCON. We assume the relationship has been broken when there has been a violation of the child. So the question becomes, will they be allowed to reestablish a relationship with ISKCON and under what boundaries?
How do we notify temples of perpetrators? In the sense that there may be 20 people or 25 people on a most obnoxious list, you know, of perpetrators. And here we are sitting in our temple. Now, we don't know who's who and what's what, so how can we increase the awareness of looking for those very obvious perpetrators who go from temple to temple and basically take advantage of the situation, and they play off on the ignorance of not knowing, just like, for instance, somebody came from Mayapur to Vrindavan, and they're looking for service. So I said, well, you know, I need a reference letter, I need this and that, and then I found out that there was some issue with him. So here he goes from a big temple to another big temple, but we have no clue until we start digging. So you might want to say, how do you plan to notify temples of the top, you know, top most disgusting people?
Okay. It's really the responsibility of the temple management to conduct screening. Someone who's using ISKCON property wants to give even a better phone call. The local management, it's important that they get in the habits of contacting the child protection office to find out if there has been a concern or a case regarding that individual. It's certainly a change in how ISKCON has operated up until now, thinking about those individuals that send the office on going to the altar, even reside at our temples, but that's a privilege, it's not a right. And doing due diligence of conducting a background check, contacting the child protection office is free. It's just an email. It does require a time gap between the person being able to do the service and that inquiry being made, so that's a bit of a shift. But it's a responsibility of the local management to contact the CPO rather than the CPO sending out lists. That list is out of date before the next day. That list may not contain useful information like the legal name or a picture of the individual. So with people having the same devotional name under several different gurus, it can become confusing and add anxiety to a situation needlessly if there's a list published. So it's the reverse, where the management contacts CPO.
That certainly is relevant. But what I'm also considering right now is, let's say, for instance, in India, to send a, as you say, the top 20 most nasty people, is to send that list to the Bureau. And then the Bureau disseminates that to the different temples in India so they're aware. And we can do a similar thing perhaps in North America, Europe, etc.
You have small pictures of the person and labeled underneath
the certificate. If the child protection office has already certified that so-and-so Dash is, you know, is this and that, you know, in a community services, like any post office has, you know, they want to show people who are the criminals, so that in case you see one, that you know, you have authorities. So, you know, the people can't just sneak around, especially if they're really actively wanting to be part of. They may not come and, you know, take on service or this and that. They may just be visiting the temple. But if we see that, hey, that so-and-so, you know, should be like...
Well, that's something that we're certainly formulating right now. And hopefully we can roll that out in a matter of months, if not sooner, for the different jurisdictions.
What about the liability concerns for doing that? Since we're not a court...
The liability concern is certainly there, but if the case has been adjudicated and there are set sanctions that were put forward, then we can publicise that and say that, let's say for instance, within the sanctions, is that they're not allowed to attend any temple, stay overnight, etc., then there's nothing stopping us informing the management of those sanctions.
It doesn't say any detail beyond
exactly.
Can't stay there, can't do class,
yeah,
whatever.
It'll just be the sanctions.
So it removes the potentially automatic information,
yes.
Just as the,
yeah.
This person is not allowed in temple.
Yeah. Does the same. There won't be any more pertinent detail than that.
Okay.
So all those cases will be sent to every temple from the CPO? Like every adjudicated case in ISKCON,
mm-hmm.
would be sent now to every temple that has a CPT?
Not necessarily, because again, you know, as we said, different names, etc. We haven't got photographs for all the cases that we've dealt with. But going forward, I'm trying to formulate what we do in certain jurisdictions. So for instance, in India, we inform the Bureau with that information, and then the Bureau passes that out to the temples in India. It doesn't necessarily have to go global. So that's what I'm trying to formulate right now.
Because of the, it takes time to adjudicate these cases,
mm-hmm.
and so we have suspected or alleged abusers going from temple to temple.
Yeah.
Any suggestion on how
the
that
suggestion
can be?
There, it comes down to the current system that we have of screening. So
mm-hmm.
if someone comes to you, then the first port of call really is to the international office via an email to ask for clearance of that person. So for instance, in Mayapur, anyone that goes to Mayapur, they apply directly to international office for clearance. So this is something that we want all the centres to do. So that takes care of the interim situation. And it will also take care of the previous cases that we've dealt with through the screening process. Yeah.
I just wanted to add one thing that, you know, this kind of, this side of it is just offenders that we know about. There's also lots of offenders, unfortunately, in our community that we're not aware of. So information sharing is one thing, but the other thing is that parents also have to be very vigilant in supervising their children. You know, it is up to the local temples and local child protection teams to make sure that children are being supervised properly. That's probably one of the main ways that we can stop, you know, abuse happening in our community. So, yeah, information sharing is there, definitely, but it's up to all of us as a community to make sure we are supervising our children as well. Because, like I said, these are just offenders that we know about.
Yeah, certainly I agree with that, but as the educational and the awareness programs are becoming more frequent, there's so many more cases. Like, we can get several cases at each event that we, at each educational event. So it's a little overwhelming to think, you know, that it's going to take so much time to get these, you know, get this investigation going. It seems like we need so much more support from the community. As you were saying, of course, the parents have to take responsibility for knowing where their children are and who they're with. And it is one of the biggest problems we do have on our compound in Vrindavan, is the lack of supervision of the children by the parents. Sometimes it feels like the educational seminars that we do end up, you know, we're not able to process the abusers as quickly as we should be able to before they've moved on again to another place.
I was just going to say that each temple has a local child protection team member, and anything that happens in their vicinity, they will inform the temple management. But even that is on a need-to-know basis, you know, because you don't want the whole of the temple management knowing. It's got to be just a few select people. So in that way, locally, those things are taken care of. As a local perpetrator, CPT will inform the temple president, and they know who can come and who can't come. When that person starts travelling, obviously it's a bigger problem, like you had recently, one person going from Mayapur to Vrindavan. But Mayapur's, the whole plan is to actually have more CPO directors, like Lila Sukha Prabhu, Ashwini Prabhu, in their places, so they can be communicating with each other, especially in India. You're going to need more than one director, South America, Russia. Yes. Yeah, but I mean, eventually that network of communication will make things a lot easier. And I also, we also do get sent, often local devotees know, and they travel and they do send us emails. We think this person's restricted. What can you do about that? Because I've seen them doing X, Y, and Z in this particular place. So, you know, we all have a personal responsibility to be the eyes and ears as well, because we're just an office, and we haven't got the resources at the moment to fulfill that remit of actually informing everybody of every situation, but that's what we're working towards.
She had mentioned people who have interim restrictions. We're assuming that if we can send out people who have had cases judged against them, we can send out their information with just the restrictions. It would seem that the interim folks could do the same. That, you know, main restriction, no more detail than that, it would seem like they'd do the same thing.
Yeah, I'm happy to do that, because that makes sense. You know, if someone does have interim restrictions, then it means that we are moving forward with that case and adjudicating that. And that needs to be monitored, so, yeah.
It's really the why that gets...
The why can't be there, but also a caveat to interim is then we'll have a process, or we have to have a process, once a case has been adjudicated, and if they've found that there's no case to answer, then we have to send out a communication saying, you know, yeah, it's no longer a case to answer.
Then there'll be a reason to hold back on the interim folks, okay?
Yeah, we have to be careful.
I guess I wanted to understand what, like, sometimes Okay, sometimes I'm just enacting the restrictions that were adjudicated by the review panel members on a case. So then I have to approach the accused and say, you can't be here anymore. Now the whole community is asking, what did you do? Why is that? So I need to know, like, what's the limit of what I can say about that person? And some other things happen here too, like I hear that a person has committed I don't know if it's technically a crime, but I think it would be considered a crime, some kind of a sex crime, and then I have to ban them from coming to the temple until it's worked out with the legal authorities. And then people say, well, why do you stop that person from coming to the temple? Like, what's the limit of what I should reveal to the general mass of devotees?
I would give as little information as possible, just that they're not allowed, they've got restrictions on them.
Wish I had done it. Glad I did it.
Yeah.
No.
But they have restrictions on them, and it's, you know, that's actually all they need to know. They don't need to know any of those details, really. I mean, it's just restrictions.
See, my thing is, as awareness builds up on child protection within your temple, then your community and devotees will then understand that if someone is being restricted from coming to the temple, then it's something fairly serious. You don't embark on something like this on a whim. Also, you can explain and say, look, I can't give you details because of confidentiality, right? You know, I cannot step over someone's rights as far as confidentiality is concerned. At the moment, it's that investigation stage. So if we do break that confidentiality and it's unfounded, then it's not fair.
I mean, after the
event, it's a case of, well, the case has been investigated, it's been adjudicated, and it's been decided that these are the sanctions. You did not, and you can say, you know, I did not, or was not a party to these sanctions, but they've come from the Child Protection Office, and we have to adhere to them, and I can't debate them with you, full stop.
Can I ask a question about past cases? I just wanted to put another thought out there for this discussion. Other churches have grappled with, how do we notify our congregation? How do we have this discussion with our community members when there's been an allegation, especially when that allegation's been proven true? But I would say that we haven't found a blanket conclusion about how do you handle that. But as a temple president for one particular temple, it's something that you could speak with your board about, and somebody could research, how do we handle that in our community? Well, certainly at New Orleans Realty, it comes up regularly.
Why can't you just name and shame?
Why do you have to,
it's already been proven, everyone knows. So just come out and say it.
What's the point? It may or may not be proven. Like, I was thinking of one church where there was an allegation and it wasn't proven, and a girl came forward, the priest thought they could counsel the person, it wasn't proven in a court of law, they didn't notify their congregation, it ended up happening again, and then they wished that they had. How do you do that? Do you say, we're going to have a Q&A this week about everybody that's banned? You know, how do you actually carry that out? So it's something that a local temple can consider. How do we want to manage this for our community? And maybe a good solution could arise.
I think it's really important that you ask that, because it's such a sensitive thing. And in order for a victim to even come forward and make this disclosure is such a big thing. So in our community, because there's no anonymity, and this is the problem we have, everyone is connected to everybody else. So if you start mentioning that a certain perpetrators had restrictions on them because of X, Y, and Z, and name and shame, it wouldn't take many people to connect the dots to the victim, and that might be devastating for them.
To protect the victim,
I think it's to protect the victim, not the perpetrator. Yeah, because we're so close, you know, such a close community, even international, we all know each other, so.
But
yeah, no, that person would be restricted, but if communicating that to the whole community might link them right back to the victims, which might be devastating for them, you know. I mean, you even have cases where we have victims that don't know each other, you know, and so when the perpetrator responds to the allegations, we have to be careful how we even give those responses individually to each victim, because they actually want to protect their own privacy most of the time. I would say that's the thing, and they're paramount, really.
For the victim set,
yeah.
And one more thing, Kelson, it's who said that they're guilty. So if a court of law does, then if we report that someone was convicted for whatever it is, but if the CPO decides ecclesiastically amongst themselves with their own set of rules that someone's guilty, if they don't have standing per se to say someone's guilty of that, they could be sued for libel.
Okay.
So guilty by whom? So the court of law, that's their job. Their job is to keep them from the temple, and the decision may go by a different process to make a conclusion.
Then you cannot, because of that,
is it being recorded? Full
stream? Yes.
Is it being recorded as well? Okay, good. So basically that's how it is. Because of the outside jurisdiction and the court of law, we cannot publicly mention that person's name. That's the understanding. That's how it is. Okay.
I think the worry about being super slanderous is a very secondary thing. I think the revealing the identity of the victim is a paramount worry in that situation, really.
Understandable.
See, quite honestly, you know, dependent on the abuse, then as a CPO director, if we're fairly certain that that person has done what they've done, then I will not be scared off by threats of legal cases, etc. But, as has already been stated, confidentiality is primarily there to protect the victim, because they've already been through a trauma, and quite a lot of the time they don't want it publicized within our close-knit community that they've been through that. So, you know, that's one of the main reasons why we protect the identity.
I think one of the most important things I've learned is that these people that have suffered abuse, they don't want to be defined by it. And they're walking around the temple and someone's pointing, oh, there's that person so-and-so abused, or there's such and such. Even the word victim is, you know, quite horrible for a lot of them. So they just don't want to be defined by it. So the more confidentiality there is, the better, which obviously makes our roles even more difficult to communicate to different temples that restriction. And that's something we're really working on, to try and get a better system in place, because that's what we want to do, make sure they're following their restrictions.
So, what
you're
saying is that there's like predatory,
that
they're going around.
Are they actually predators that go to temples to do these, you know, engage in these type of activities? And then as congregational members, what are we to be looking for? And one last statement has it gotten better in terms of child abuse? And I wouldn't say worldwide, but just in North America, has it gotten better? The cases going down, or how's that?
I think I'll let you answer the second part of it there. I think initially why this has happened in our society is because we as devotees think we are above these things, but we're no different to the secular society where this has invaded every single, school, after school club, families, step family. It's just everywhere. And we're no different. You know, there are devotees that have that propensity here, and that's why we have to have our child protection teams to deal with it. Otherwise, we wouldn't have any service to do. But we're always, I don't know what it is in America, let Lucilla answer that, but we are busy a lot of the time. Way too busy for our liking, really. So, yeah.
And again, answer your question, are they predators or not? Child abusers come in many different forms, right? Some will actively predate on children. Some will take it as an opportunity, if the opportunity arises, they'll abuse children, etc. But another thing that we have to remember is child abuse isn't just sexual. Right? It comes in different categories, such as physical, emotional, etc. So, child abuse isn't just the sexual child abuse that perhaps paedophiles perform, etc. So it comes in many different guises.
Do you want to answer about North America?
North America is no worse or no better than any other country in the world. We just represent, as ISKCON, we represent a slice of the outside community. Right? Our figures are the same as the secular community that we live in. So it's no better or no worse.
So I realize that by taking up the service, you inherit a whole path for decades, right? And what I remember is, I hear devotees sometimes blasting somebody who's a male abuser as if it will never be complete for that person, for that perpetrator. I'm just wondering, have you ever considered how to effectively complete cases that are just, seems like they're just never ending and if devotees marry them?
I think, Lilith can tell you more about what's going on here, but I think from my experience, it's very hard to get devotees to actually make an official complaint sometimes. And sometimes you get little pieces of information, and it's just like a jigsaw puzzle. So you've got one piece of information from here which maybe doesn't seem that significant, then another piece from somebody else, and it might go in a complaint file. But until somebody actually makes an official complaint and wants to go ahead with the case, then it's we're still in that complaint file. It doesn't.
Is that what you meant?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I know people.
I understand now. Your question is there any closure for the perpetrator who has perpetrated a child abuse case previously? Well, yes, there is. They get certain sanctions that they have to abide by and meet. And quite a lot of these sanctions have a time limit. They can't perform X, Y, and Z for a number of years. Some will have lifetime bans, etc. But they know the conditions that they have to abide by. And if they abide by those conditions, then, they can rehabilitate. But, quite a lot of the time with child abuse, they will be certain lifetime bans, such as they'll never ever be allowed to be working with children, for instance, or have service connected to children, sometimes in positions of leadership, etc. So there'll always be some lifetime conditions, because we have to manage the risk and the potential propensity of that person. But also, we try not to throw them away permanently. So that's there, but it depends on the type of child abuse that they've carried out and also their propensity or their openness regarding that.
Maybe historically there's been some lack of consistency in the sanctions or the restrictions, so that can be frustrating for people, possibly?
That's certainly there. Historically, we've had one or two cases like that. Mm-hmm. As far as consistency is concerned, that was in the early days.
Mm-hmm.
But I think we've ironed out quite a lot of those wrinkles. And even historically, they've been fairly rare on the inconsistencies, but I accept that they have been there. They have been there.
Okay.
Yes, you gave an example of emotional, well, you didn't give an example, but can you give me an example of some emotional abuse that might be perpetrated?
Emotional abuse to a victim, I presume that's why what you're asking about. That could be anything from if they've seen their friend abused, if their teacher has put them down in some way. It could be anything. That's more mentally and emotional instead of physical. Anything that's not physical, that would be...
It could be anything from, you know, a parent or teacher ripping up their work even, saying that's rubbish and putting it in the bin. You're useless, you know, you'll never amount to anything. That sort of thing, you know, you're... Sorry? You look like a prostitute. It could be anything. Anything that's derogatory to that person's well-being, basically, emotionally.
It could be anything. We may think it's small, or it may not be small, but it could be any form.
You see, we've seen a lot of emotional abuse. And quite a lot of the time when you just turn around and say emotional, then that doesn't seem so serious. But when you talk to victims, and they actually relay what they've been through, and it's usually systematic over a period of time, and usually a long period of time, that has a huge effect on their well-being and the way that they think about themselves, their organization, and everyone else around them. And it doesn't just last for a number, it lasts a whole lifetime unless they're given that help. So, you know, we categorize all this abuse as equally bad, if you like, or equally in the same category. Because unfortunately, there is this perception that sexual abuse is the most serious, and then it goes down into degrees. And things like emotional abuse, etc., is right down the bottom. But in my book, they're all equal because of the effects and the long-term effects that it has on the victims.
As a personal note for yourself, how are you going to stop the good old boys club that goes around within ISKCON?
Uh-huh. Yeah, good old boys.
You touched on it a little bit yourself. Yes, everyone knows each other around the world. We all grew up together. Well, in some way. When I say good old boys club, everyone likes to scratch each other's back, look out for each other, even when bad things happen. How, as a director yourself, is it going to change that?
Okay. The way to change it is to make sure that we have stringent procedures that we follow, right? And we don't deviate from those procedures for the sake of this person that we're dealing with or another person. My strap line is that I want to deal with, let's say, a ghoul GBC who has an allegation against him or her the same way as I want to deal with a case with a pot washer, right? And if we apply that, then what we will get is buy-in from our whole society. You know, that way we eliminate any doubt. We eliminate disfranchisement, which has happened in the past. And as a result, we get so many devotees coming up to us and saying, well, look, you know, don't talk to me about child protection. Because, you know, of X, Y, and Z case, this is what happened and there was a travesty. So you don't really care anyway. So please don't talk to me about that. So in order to assure, and in order to get confidence back again, we have to be balanced across the board and not be influenced by, and let's face it, not be influenced by bodies such as the GBC or so-called senior devotees, etc. Yeah, we have to be balanced across the board, and that's one thing I aim to do.
Another aspect of ensuring that that dynamic is not the deciding factor is education. So we're doing a lot of effort for increasing education. Every adult has a responsibility in the lives of the children around them. When adults inform themselves, they become part of a critical mass that even if there's one manager who is tending to go in a certain direction, it cannot be sustained in an environment of informed people. So education is a big part of moving away from birth club, as you say.
Hare Krishna. First, I just want to say thank you, guys, for, I really appreciate you guys being here. I think in my 37 years of being a devotee or a guru kuli, I think this is the first time that I've actually seen people that are going the extra mile and trying to get justice for us victims. So thank you. I appreciate that. I got here a little late, so I don't know if anybody's asked this, but when is it going to be a time for us that I understand that we do need to have a CPO within our society, but not once have we taken cases out of this, you know what I mean, like out of this community. You know what I mean? It's all dealt inside, internally, but we've never gone to police. People have never been, maybe, I don't know if people have been arrested recently, but it's time for us to start getting the police involved. As soon as there's anything involved with child molestation or anything, we need to contact the police. That's what needs to happen. So when is that going to start happening?
The ISKCON policy, the first item, is that we report to local law enforcement. Unfortunately, local law enforcement has a 2-3% conviction rate. Reason being,
ISKCON has probably zero.
I'm sorry.
Police have zero, maybe, or whatever percent, but we, within our society, we have zero. We just keep rolling them around to other, like, communities.
There are numerous cases where the person has gone through the court system. However, the majority of the cases aren't able to go through the court system because the court system won't take them. The court system doesn't take cases that are past the statute of limitations. They don't take cases like if both parties are here, say both parties are in Colorado and the allegation happened in Fiji, they don't take it. The ISKCON system is set up to handle that extra mile. Can we make a decision on something that isn't handled by the court system? But our first policy is to report to law enforcement.
In England, we often have cases, the judicial system there is complex. And if you take a case to the police, which is always our first port of call, we always say to the person disclosing to us, now let's go to the police. It's the first thing we do. And we've often had cases where there's been evidence in black and white of grooming, of all sorts of, you know, unsavory behaviour from an adult to a child. Person gets arrested, the lawyers are building up a case against that person, and it gets to the, just before it's due to go to court, it gets looked at by the Crown Prosecution to see, is there enough evidence? And there's most of the time they say there's not enough evidence. Every now and then there's no evidence, and the person can get, in one case in England, they had got 15 years in prison, and it's just the girl's word against the person, the perpetrator's word. And in other cases, they say that's not enough. But either way, if it's not enough to go to court, it still comes back to the CPO to determine what access that person has to ISCOM. Because it's not that there's no evidence of them doing something wrong, there's some evidence, and now we have to figure out what risk that person is to our society, and that's what the review panel members are for, and the local child protection teams are for.
I guess who reviews those panels, and then who are those judges that review those things?
You want
There's devotees who are specifically trained for that certain service. They're called review panel members. And unlike in a court system where the jury has zero training and they just come in and make their decision based on their own life experience with basically no guidance, these devotees are selected based on the likeliness of them to be good at this service, and then they're given 3 days training minimum. Continuing education sometimes, if we're able. And from that pool of devotees that are trained for that particular service, three are selected per case that do not know any of the parties involved to attempt complete objectivity.
Legal resources for victims, for example, like in regular legal society or society at large, if a person is poor and they have a complex case and DNA evidence might be something that makes a difference, but they don't have the resources to make that happen. So is there like a fund or something for victims in that regard?
Very, very, very seldom would we require that level of evidence. As far as the victims are concerned, then, you know, we would always assign advocates, etc., to help them in making their complaint, in making their statements, etc. So the support is there, regardless of their financial position or not. So we'd always ensure that that's there. No, it means for the case.
There's been some notable failures in our society to properly deal with people. And some of those are rather well known. Yet we don't know a lot about the successful cases because of the nature of the business. You can't really publicize in the same way. Can you speak somewhat about, about some of the successes that have been there? At least cases, there have been cases that are adjudicated. There are people who have sanctions against them. Is that something maybe you could talk about a little bit?
We've had quite a few. Do you mean cases where there are restrictions in place or cases where they're not allowed to come to the temple anymore at all? Do you just mean overall? I'm not clear what you...
There's a number of them. Can you give any kind of figures that might help people realize that there is, despite all the failures, that there's...
Yeah, I mean, definitely. Like, for example, I can tell you we've had a few cases in the UK where there have been allegations of, child abuse, and won't discuss the details. And in some of those cases, those devotees have been told they're not allowed to come to not just our local temple, but any ISKCON temples all over the world. In some cases, they're not allowed to come for a certain period of time, but even when they come back, they're not allowed to then, give class, lead kirtan. We were just discussing how, one of our plans for this year is to start compiling reports for community, devotees that you know, these are the number of cases we've dealt with this year. These are the number of people who, you know, have no access to our temples anymore. So that, you know, like you said, yeah, our failings are very highlighted, but the positive things that we're doing, including all the training, that information hopefully, you know, will also be available to devotees. But yeah, unfortunately, the positive cases that we do deal with, again, because of confidentiality and not wanting to share details of, you know, victims, it is hard to kind of get that across, to show that.
Yeah, going on the figures, we've had just over 100 cases that we've dealt with in the CPO office since its inception. They have been adjudicated and sanctions placed on these people. Just over 100 just in the last 9 months. We've dealt with 10 cases, and 4 more have just come up. So what happens is that as awareness goes up, as training takes place, then more and more of these cases are going to come forward. Why? Because then people are educated as to what child abuse is. And secondly, and more importantly, they feel confident that if they go and report something, something will be done. Because it is traumatic for these victims to actually report what has happened to them, and then have the confidence that it's going to be dealt with in the right way.
So, someone mentioned the training for the,